Hi, I'm David Kleon, senior editor at Blogging Heads TV. This is another episode of Worldwise. I'm speaking from New York City, and I'm speaking once again with Volodymyr Yermolenko, who is in Kiev, Ukraine. Volodymyr and I last spoke in December, and we can link to that. But Volodymyr, why don't you reintroduce yourself?
Well, my name is Volodymyr Yermolenko, and I'm working at Internews Ukraine, which is an international NGO media-focused NGO based in Kiev, and I'm a philosopher and political analyst and also media analyst.
Great. So when we last spoke in December, I think the protests that were raging in Kiev had been going on for about 2 weeks, and for the most part were very peaceful. You know, it was one of these giant mass demonstrations we've seen all around the world with a lot of young people, a lot of social media, and they were, I don't want to recap this too extensively, but the main reason they were protesting was because the Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, had rejected an association agreement with the European Union under pressure from Russian President Vladimir Putin, who wants to simplify things, wants Ukraine to be a satellite of Russia as it has been historically. Since then, in the last few weeks, the protests have gotten a lot more dramatic. There have been pictures circulating on the internet of giant fires in the streets of Kiev, this kind of hellish scene. Several people have died. I think at one point the protesters brought out a catapult. Before we get into some of the political maneuverings that have happened recently, Volodymyr, can you just describe what's actually been going on in the ground in Kiev since we last spoke? How bad is it?
Well, we were talking about the peaceful protests, and basically they were peaceful for 2 months, right? Mm-hmm. So they started on 21st of November, and basically they were more or less peaceful until the 19th of January. So for 2 months, Ukrainian people in Kiev and from many other regions were staying on Maidan, in the central square. Maidan Nezalezhnosti, on the independent square, under snow, under rain, under very bad conditions. You know, in Kiev we have frosts right now, and very severe frosts, especially in the nights. So many people also were staying during the nights, and basically none of their demands was heard, and instead of, you know, some concessions, the government, instead of, you know, going to, instead of trying to hear the people, instead of trying to negotiate with the people and with the opposition, the government was kind of an opening, a very aggressive war against these protesters. First, they tried several times, three times at least, to violently disperse the protests, the Maidan. Second, it basically, what is even more intimidating and indignant, I would say, is that the government and some forces behind it, probably even not very much controlled by the government, were following the most active protesters and aggressed them and beat them very severely. So we got the journalist Tatiana Chernobyl, who was very severely beaten and who miraculously survived. We have another activist, Igor Lutsenko, who was also kidnapped and left in the forest to freeze, and he miraculously survived too, but his fellow colleague Yuri Verbitsky didn't survive, so he died in the forest. And many other cases as well. There are also cases of people who are missing, so we don't know where they are. There are about 30 people missing. And then in this situation, when, imagine you got for 2 months in very cold weather, under snow, you got people on Maidan, every day under threat of attack from the police, then you have very legitimate, basically, requirements, early presidential election. That's that was the first requirement, which is very legitimate democratic requirement, you know. So the requirement was to early election, which would test the president's capacity and the president's popularity, right? And no response to these demands. Instead, these attempts of aggressive dispersal and these attacks, very targeted attacks on the most active activists. And then you got the parliament adopted on 16th of January the laws, which are absolutely horrible.
Tell us about these laws. These are the
there are many tricky things and many funny things. For example, the organizations, civil society organizations, who get some funds from foreign organizations, for example, from international funds or international organizations, they should register themselves in 3 months, saying in their titles, that they're agents of foreign influence. So imagine you got an organization like us, Internews Ukraine, and you would need to say, well, the official organization, the official name would be Agent of Foreign Influence, Internews Ukraine. And then you will have a criminal responsibility for a libel and for defamation. So imagine journalists publishing, you know, information about assets of oligarchs, of Ukrainian oligarchs abroad, and then courts will decide that this is a defamation or libel, and then these journalists will be put to prison, you know. And
this is a series of crackdowns on free speech, free press.
Assembly. So they were copied not even from Russian laws, but from Belarusian law. So you have a very the last authoritarian country in Europe, Belarus, and you have Yanukovych people copying these laws, and then they were adopted in a very funny way because the opposition tried to block the usual electronic system of voting, and basically these laws were voted by hands in the parliament by this group of people, and they were pretending they were majority. The majority is 226. But basically, when you got the photo of the people who were voting with their hands, you can count only about 100. So they didn't even count these hands. So the laws were not only absolutely authoritarian and undemocratic; they were adopted in a non-legitimate way, you know.
Yes.
And with many violations. And of course, imagine these three factors. You got these 2 months of more or less peaceful protests under snow and very hot weather conditions. You got the government, the administration is deaf. They are attacking you, and they're basically making a war on you and attacking the most active people and basically intimidating everybody. And then you got even try to legally justify it, so to provide a legal basis for further attacks. And the opposition, the three opposition parties were, well, basically the key thing about today's protests is that, well, they started as a civic movement, as a something bottom-up movement, right? And there were always tensions between the protests and the official three opposition parties. And basically, the opposition parties don't lead this movement. They are led by this movement. So they basically hear to what people say on Maidan, and they basically follow what they say. And then, given this situation, there were, of course, there were people who were more radically reacting to it, like 2 months without results. And there were the key clashes began on the 19th of January, and they were just trying to move to the parliamentary building in order to pick at them, and then police stopped them for some reason because the government quarter of Kyiv is blocked by the police. You cannot enter it. And then there were clashes. So the pictures that you see with fire, and everything, they're not pictures from all over Kyiv. There's just one place on Rushevskoe Street.
And where is Rushevskoe Street? What?
Well, Rushevskoe Street is about, let's say, 200 meters from Maidan or 300 meters from Maidan. So
this is the very heart of Kyiv and near the major.
Yeah, this is the downtown of Kyiv. And this is a street leading to the government quarter. So if you want, there is a major street, one of the several major streets, but the biggest, probably the widest street, which leads from this protest headquarters, Maidan and European Square, to the government quarter, in which you have parliament, you have government, you have presidential administration, you have national bank and all other institutions. So, and you got the first, the several police block posts there, and the clashes were between protesters and the first. So that's briefly it. And the clashes began. The protesters were throwing the, how to say, I don't know how to say it, is bottles of cocktails, of Molotov, Molotov cocktails, right, and stones. But in return, police shot first with rubber bullets, but then with the real bullets, and using firearms, and using the grenades, but not the explosive grenades, but those tear gas, yes, but those, yeah, also grenades which provoke injuries, serious injuries.
Oh wow!
And it in total we got several people killed, and in total we got from different estimates from 5 to 7 people who are killed, who are either shot dead or found in the forest nearby Kyiv. And then you got about 30 people missing.
So have you been out and seen these more violent demonstrations personally, or seen their aftermath?
Yeah, of course. So everybody is going there, and I'm not participating in these attacks, but I'm following that, and I'm very, 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 very closely, and almost every day, many of us go to this place,
to
even those who are not participating in attacks, they need to support people who are standing against the police and against this, well, forces which are not that much police, but which are basically the authoritarian forces and the guardians of the authoritarian regime. Because when you got a lesser number of people, police attacks. So police attacks only when you got a few, several hundreds of people, and that was the attack last week when early in the morning there were not so many protesters and then police attack.
So these demonstrations have also spread well beyond Kyiv. There've been maps circulating on Twitter and elsewhere showing extensive protests in most parts of the country, especially in the West, which has traditionally leaned more toward European integration. How extensive are the protests? Because I'm hearing two different kinds of spin. I'm hearing on the one hand that this is a handful of local demonstrations in a handful of cities, especially in Western Ukraine. And on the other hand, I'm hearing that this is a major insurrection and that the country could, be torn apart or the government could be overthrown. How, as best as you can tell from Kyiv, how extensive are the protests? How extensive is the violence?
Surely we cannot speak about handful of demonstrations. Of course, this is a very massive movement. Massive movement involving, in Kyiv only involving hundreds of thousands of people, but throughout Ukraine involving probably a million of people, And And in Western Ukraine, basically, people were capturing the... There are two types of regional, you know, powers in Ukraine. One which is bottom-up, and which are regional councils, and the other which is top-down, which are regional administrations. So the people appointed from Kiev and from Yanukovych administration to govern the region. Mm-hmm. So the people in these regions were capturing these administrations, so the instruments of the central government in their regions.
They're literally seizing the federal office buildings in their cities, right?
Yeah. And basically in the Western Ukraine, there is no conflict between, so the process is quite easy because even the representatives of the central powers, they go to the side of protesters, and even the police sometimes often goes to the side of protesters in Lviv or other cities. In the central Ukraine, it's much more tricky, much less easy because, you know, there are several thousands of protesters who try to capture the power, and then you got all these repressive forces who push them back. So you got very serious tensions, for example, in some central cities like Cherkasy or Sumy or others. And then you got Eastern Ukraine, of course, in which probably the people who are passively supporting the current regime are more numerous than those who are challenging it. So
are there major protests going on in Eastern Ukrainian cities like Donetsk, for example, or?
Well, in Donetsk, it's very tricky because in Donetsk and Lugansk and to some extent Dnipropetrovsk or Kharkiv, they're traditionally more, of course, more. I wouldn't say pro-Russian, but kind of a skeptical concerning the West, and of course it will not be easy that transformation, if it will be any to the Western values, will be not easy and will be not quick.
Right. So, I should just establish as background once again that Ukraine, which got independence from the Soviet Union in 1991, had never been an independent country with its current borders before then, and is actually composed of some distinct regions with distinct histories. And to simplify extremely, the western part of the country historically was connected to Poland and Austria, and so is much more in the kind of Central European, or you could even say Western European, tradition. Whereas the eastern part of the country has been dominated by Russia for a very, very long time, or was before 1991, and has a much larger ethnic Russian and Russian-speaking population. And the Yanukovych, who was democratically elected a few years ago, his base of support is Eastern Ukraine, whereas the westernmost parts of the country have always been very opposed to him. Is that a fair summary of Ukraine and its regions, or would you complicate that?
Yeah, it's more or less right, with the several clarifications, is that Ukraine was actually independent from 1917 to 1920, with some, you know, always there were some peculiarities, but
Ukraine enjoyed a brief spell of independence during and after World War One and during the Russian Revolution,
exactly.
but it was constantly falling apart or being invaded
But the interesting thing is that, for example, if you take the this Clash of Civilizations thesis by Huntington, right, very popular, I think, in the US, he draws the line of this clash of civilizations through Ukraine, right. But this line is in Ukraine, between the West and the East, between the Western civilization and the Eastern civilization. For him, it is the line between the Greco-Catholic regions Orthodox regions.
Right, because large parts of Western Ukraine practice a a version of Roman Catholicism that aesthetically resembles Orthodoxy, but the Pope in Rome recognizes them and they recognize him, whereas in Eastern Ukraine they practice Orthodox Christianity, more similar, I guess, to what's practiced in Russia. So but there's huge overlap, I guess.
But an interesting thing is that basically this line of divide is now has gone much more to the east. So it's covering many Orthodox regions. It's not covering only these Greco-Catholic regions. It's covering also these regions with traditional Orthodox church. And now, if you take the confessions question, the religious question, you have, of course, Greco-Catholic Church is behind the protests, is supporting the protests, but then you have the Orthodox Church of Kyiv Patriarchate, which is not recognized by Moscow, and which is also very white and widely supported by Ukrainians, which also supports and backs the protests.
So in Eastern Ukraine, there are some actual Russian Orthodox.
In Eastern Ukraine, but also throughout Ukraine, you got the Orthodox Church of Moscow Patriarchate. So the division is basically, is of course there. It would be naive to deny it. But this division is fluctuating, and it's, in my opinion, it's moving gradually to the east. So the pro-Western Ukraine, pro-Western people in Ukraine are becoming more numerous than pro-Eastern. Another example is language. Because Kyiv is majorly, Kyiv is a Russian-speaking region, not Ukrainian. There are, of course, Ukrainian is sometimes over these years, and interestingly enough, from the beginning of the protests, started imposing itself, not imposing, I mean organically imposing, so started being more popular and more spoken. But basically, Kyiv remains a Russian-speaking city. But
a lot of people in central Ukraine speak a sort of mix of the two languages.
Exactly. Yeah. But what I would like to stress is that there are many Russian-speaking people who support this protest and who participate in this protest and who organize this protest. Basically, if you take the leading activists of these Maidan, you will have probably even more Russian speakers than Ukrainian speakers, or at least there will be 50-50, right? So this civilizational clash is there, but it's not really matching exactly what's going on. So there are many Orthodox people who are supporting the protests, and there are many Russian speakers who are supporting the protests.
But is it fair to say that almost all Greek Catholics and pure Ukrainian speakers are in favor of the protest? Are there dissenters on that side?
More or less.
So there's unified Western support for the protest, and then you see increasing support in the central and eastern parts of the country across demographic, or if we want to say civilizational lines. I remember you said in our last conversation, you think the ultimate divide here is generational, that young people everywhere are in favor of more integration with Europe and less association with Russia?
Yes, the generation is very important. But still, I mean, I wouldn't exaggerate it. Because, for example, if you take young people, you will see that even young people from Kharkiv, from Dnipropetrovsk, of course, are much more pro-Western oriented. But still, I mean, you cannot say that everybody is pro-Western oriented. So it would be naive to expect that, for example, Donetsk will be thinking in the same way as Lviv in 20 years or 30 years. Of course, the divides will survive and will be there, and we have to understand that. The Ukraine is a very diverse country, and diversities are very big asset. And the fact that many people here are bilingual, speaking Ukrainian and Russian fluently and switching from one to another is a very good thing, I think.
So actually, we've talked so much just now about cultural divisions within the country, historical, religious, linguistic, and so on. But there must be actual practical material concerns for people who support or oppose the protest. What exactly would, if Yanukovych had signed the association agreement with the European Union, what would that actually do or what do people think that would do for Ukraine, and why are there people who wouldn't want that? What are the sort of economic concerns at stake here, briefly?
Well, I wouldn't exaggerate the role of the association agreement, because I read the agreement and tried to read it, because I'm professionally very much, you know, focusing on the EU integration and everything. But it would be naive to believe that people who went to this, who took on this to the streets, have read the agreement. It's a very technical thing and very bureaucratic thing, and very difficult to understand, you know. So there is more like a mythology of the EU integration, more like the people supporting the idea of Europe rather than the concrete association agreement. What would it bring? Well, it brings certain, the two key things which the association agreement would bring to Ukrainians are the decrease of tariffs from both sides on most goods, so the trade will be very much liberalized with Europe. And the second thing is that Ukraine will be approximating to EU legislation in many very interesting ways. For example, it would adopt the competition law, the EU competition law, antitrust law, or it would adopt public procurement law, which would safeguard, you know, Ukrainian public state tenders against corruption. Or it would adopt Europe's environmental norms like air quality, etc., etc. Or it would liberalize business. But again, all of that
must be very threatening for Ukraine's oligarchs. It's established oligarchs, right? Who I think it's fair to say are extremely corrupt. On the one hand,
it's threatening, but on the other, it's not, because, for example, it opens the way for Ukrainian oligarchs to participate in European tenders on the same basis, on the same footing as the European companies, okay. Or it puts many tariffs down so that Ukrainian companies will be able to export more freely. So there are pros and cons. There are pros and cons. What I think is dangerous is the mythology, the counter mythology, and very very powerful propaganda which is used by pro-Russian forces against this association agreement, which is indeed a total mythology and total lie. For example, the key messages spread by pro-Russian organizations is that Europe means gay marriages and association agreement means gay marriages, which is not the case, because you will not find a word about gay marriages in the agreement, because in Europe, different countries adopt different laws about gay marriages, right?
Right.
So there is much of the disinformation and misinformation about it, which sometimes, you know, influences people who are against the EU integration.
But beyond these cultural appeals like that, are there genuine economic stakeholders in Ukraine who would be threatened by more EU integration, who have a sort of concrete material reason to oppose it?
It could be, for example, it's not that they can be threatened. Is that first, as Russia is playing a very, you know, tough game, because from August they blocked Ukraine and many of the Ukrainian exports, saying, you know, if you sign this free trade association and free trade agreement, we'll have problems with our production, which is basically a propaganda, I think. But they blocked on this argument, they blocked Ukrainian exports, and mainly exports from the eastern Ukraine. So eastern Ukraine producers were suffering a lot from this trade war opened by Russia. And Russians were saying, well, this is just a preparation. If you sign this agreement, you will suffer much more. So, of course, this was an argument for those whose economy, whose production is oriented on Russian markets. And then Russians are proposing, you know, some concrete projects. I don't know whether they will work or not, but some very concrete projects in high technological fields like aviation building or space industry or whatever else. And right, this is what is lacking. This is what is lacking because Russians are proposing two major things. They're proposing money, like right. $15 billion, and they're proposing some concrete initiatives. The Europeans are proposing rules. They're saying, well, we're proposing you very good rules under which you will develop more efficiently. Mm-hmm. And there are two different arguments, you know. Well, either you propose, you know, money or you propose rules.
Right, because Russia, I guess a few weeks ago, had this $15 billion bailout, which caught everyone in the EU by surprise. And Russia also, of course, subsidizes Ukraine's energy and sells it below international market rates. Ukraine has been in an economic crisis, which is the other backdrop to all of this. And Russia is offering to sort of bail Ukraine out of that. But actually, let's turn to the politics a little bit now. So, in the last few days, Yanukovych has made a number of interesting political maneuvers. He reached out to the opposition parties and offered their leaders places in his cabinet. He, I guess, just in the last 24 hours has caved to one of the protesters' demands and dismissed, is it the Prime Minister Azarov? Is that the role
yeah,
he holds?
Yeah.
Yeah, dismissed yeah. Mykola Azarov, his Prime Minister, which is something the protesters wanted him to do. As best I understand, the opposition parties are rejecting joining Yanukovych's cabinet, but they are cooperating with him in repealing the protest laws we discussed earlier. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, today we have the resignation of the Prime Minister, which means that the whole government has resigned. And it's a very important development. Because earlier Yanukovych proposed the post of prime minister to one of the opposition leaders, Arseniy Yatsenyuk.
Yes.
But the proposal was very tricky because we got three opposition leaders, official, you know, the triumvirate, the troika. Then we got less official and opposition leaders, which are sometimes more popular on Maidan, right? But we got three opposition, I mean official in the way that they represent parliamentary opposition. They are both, they're all of them, all three are leaders of the parties represented in the parliament. And what Yanukovych did, he proposed a very good position for one of them, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who is the least popular on Maidan, by the way, but who leads the biggest faction, opposition faction in the parliament, the Tymoshenko faction.
Then Yulia Tymoshenko was Prime Minister of Ukraine and is currently in prison in Kharkiv, right, on corruption charges that Yanukovych prosecuted her with. But she does or did represent a very large part of the country, and Arseniy Yatsenyuk is leading her party now.
Yeah, exactly. So returning to this offer, he proposed the Prime Minister position to one of the leaders. He proposed a very humiliating position to the second one, who is Vitaly Klitschko, the famous worldwide known boxer.
Right.
And the position, Yanukovych proposed him a position of vice prime minister on humanitarian issues, which is kind of a joke, if you want, because Klitschko wants to be a president and he's proposed to be vice prime minister on humanitarian issues. For example, in health or education or whatever. So, and then he didn't propose anything to Chernybok, who is leading a nationalist party, Svoboda. What is that? It's basically a trick aiming at splitting the opposition. You propose everything to one of them, you propose very humiliating mockery at the second one, and you propose nothing to the third. And if first of them accepts it, of course, there will be a clash between the three. So that was a trick. Yeah.
Yulia Tymoshenko issued a statement from prison saying that she doesn't think any of them should accept this, right? That they need to hold strong.
But basically, the key demand of Maidan of all the protests is the restructuring of power, of the whole power of the whole authorities. And the first thing of this restructuring is early parliamentary elections. And Yanukovych doesn't accept that. And I think, therefore, I think that today's resignation of the government, because you should understand that in Ukraine is a presidential republic, and government is basically dependent on the president. So resignation of the government doesn't satisfy the protesters, of course. It's just, of course it's a good sign. It is sign of the certain willingness of the authorities to step back. So they were not making any step back for 2 months of peaceful protests, and then when you got these clashes, they stepped back and they proposed significant concessions. But again, I don't think that the protesters will accept that. Probably some of the opposition leaders will accept this move, but that will mean probably the end of their political career because people are against it.
Now, this suggests somewhat disturbingly that violence may actually be an effective tactic in a way that nonviolent protests may not have been, or at least not as effective. Do you see a possibility of increased violence as a result of these concessions? Or what? How do you, I mean, this is sort of a fool's game at this point, but how do you expect this to play out over the next few weeks?
Well, the violence exerted by the protesters is always a response to violence exerted by the police.
Of course.
So every time there is a certain aggression on the part of the government, the protesters respond to it. You know, when the students were dispersed in late November, then people took on the streets with hundreds of thousands of people. This violence was a response to these autocratic, authoritarian laws of 16th of January. Now the situation has calmed down a bit, so the Maidan, every time Maidan is attacked, it enlarges. People gather, people seize more buildings, and people seize much, much bigger territory. The demands of the protesters are resignation of Yanukovych or early presidential elections, which is a fine way out, because Yanukovych can also be interested in that. If he proves during the elections that he still can win, his powers will be much more legitimate, you know. So he still has a tool of these elections to legitimize him, because if he wins, he will be able to prove to everybody, you know, that, you know, I still have support. And I'm saying that to say that there is certain justification why he can do that from his own point of view. And of course, this is a major demand of the protesters to have these early presidential elections and to replace Yanukovych with somebody else.
Okay.
And there is also an idea to return to an early version of the constitution, which basically installs more like a parliamentary republic in which the prime minister has much more powers and probably to diminish the powers of the president.
So this would be a way then to have, then you would be able to hold elections and actually determine who the most popular leader of the country should be. And who do you think that would be if there were free parliamentary elections? Which faction would come out on top, and who would the leader of Ukraine be?
I'm talking about the presidential election.
No, I understand.
The parliamentary elections.
Hypothetically, if the prime minister were the actual leader of the country and not the president, and parliamentary elections were to be held tomorrow, who do you think would emerge as the leader of Ukraine? Whose faction would enjoy the most support?
Well, these factions which are actually fighting, they're the most popular. So Yanukovych Party of the Regions is still popular. They have from 25 to 28%. Then you have Batkivshina of Tymoshenko, jailed Tymoshenko and Yatsenyuk. And then you have Klitschko, who is also getting popular. At least he was very popular before the Maidan, before the protesters. And if you take the presidential elections, he is the most probable winner against Yanukovych.
This is Klitschko, the boxer, is the most.
Yeah.
So what? You said that the third party, the Svoboda Party, Freedom Party, is a right wing nationalist party. But what's the major distinction between the other two parties, between the Tymoshenko party and Klitschko's party? How would you distinguish them?
It's difficult to distinguish them ideologically. Because you don't have many ideological parties in Ukraine. Basically, you have among all the parties, if you talk about ideology, we got the nationalistic party Svoboda and then the Communist Party. All the rest are not ideological. They're constructed around the leaders. Mm-hmm. But Kivshina is constructed around Tymoshenko, and Klitschko's party Udar is constructed around Klitschko. That's it.
Okay. So
but they are, of course they are, I mean, they are, at least in their rhetoric, they are much more liberal than Party of the Regions, that they are pro-European, they want to integrate with Europe, etc.
Okay. So one last thing, and then we should probably wrap up. All of this is happening against a major international backdrop, or it's about to next week anyway, which is the Winter Olympics that are going to be held very close to Ukraine in the Russian resort city of Sochi, beginning next week, and which are widely perceived, at least here in the U.S., as a showpiece for Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, and also as a sort of slow motion disaster in which there's going to be. In which there are major terrorist threats. There's a huge amount of money being invested in security. There's been a huge amount of corruption. There's this anti-gay propaganda law in Russia, which has caused a huge amount of controversy in the U.S. and Europe. It's going to be a major. All of the eyes of the world are going to be on Putin and what he does there, and on what his Russia looks like after more than a decade in power. And of course, Putin is a major player in what's going on in Ukraine now too, and has been trying to protect the Yanukovych regime and is very threatened by the protesters. So are people in Ukraine, how conscious would you say they are of this backdrop? Are people paying attention to the Olympics? Are they paying attention to Putin and his political situation? Do they see an opportunity to dramatize their cause in the context of the Olympics? What do the Olympics matter at all to Ukraine, is what I'm asking.
The Olympics don't matter for Ukrainians because we're busy with other things, but Putin, of course, matters. And first, I think there is justified to consider that the current crisis was partially, to a very large extent, provoked by this trade commercial war opened by Russia in August, because this trade war, which meant physical blocking of Ukrainian exports to Russia because of some mythical threats from the association agreement, they basically led to the this U-turn, to Yanukovych decision to put the association agreement on hold, which provokes the protest, pro-EU protest, and then anti-Yanukovych protest, which led to current clashes. So Putin has the responsibility. Second, of course, his intelligence units are here, his intelligence specialists are here, and there are many reports in the media that they consult Yanukovych, and Yanukovych is flying often and talks often with Putin and his advisors. But as far as Olympics are concerned, I wouldn't say that this is a topic in Ukraine. So we don't really discuss it. We don't really consider in this situation, this frame.
No, I assume.
I don't know. I don't know. I can't.
Athletes to search it.
Yeah.
And
But I don't know how to look at Ukrainian situation from the prism of the Olympics, because there are two options. I see two options. I don't know how Mr. Putin thinks and what he expects, but I see two options. Either he basically wants Ukraine to calm down, you know, and because he's not interested in, you know, some turbulences, and he's not interested because many people in the West also understand that the Putin is also behind and this situation and that basically he is the one who is also to criticize and to blame for this you know, for this conflict, but and therefore he doesn't want his image to drop down before the Olympics. But on the other hand, he can be interested in the turmoil in Ukraine, saying that look, we have this funny Olympics and we have the stability in the country, we have everything cool, and then you have this democratic disaster in Ukraine. So there are two options, and I don't know what is his model of thinking.
So I guess to be a little cynical about it, it would probably be useful for the protesters in Ukraine if the Russian Olympics proved to be a disaster, which remains to be seen. If Putin were embarrassed on the global stage, that would probably be to the benefit of the protesters, or what do you think?
Well, I don't know. I basically, Ukraine, as each country, is basically focused on what's going on, right? I was talking to my French colleague journalists and who were filming the events a couple of days ago, and they had troubles of making the report to be in the headline, because France was focused on Mr. Hollande's divorce and marriages and everything that you know. So every country is focused on their issues. Of course, if you take the protests and if you try to analyze what's going on in the heads of protesters in terms of international politics, I would say that first thing is that they ask and they plead the international community to be with them, and in particular to be probably more firm and to impose sanctions on some particular personalities, to impose visa bans and account freezes or sanctions against companies linked to the regime.
Right.
And this is the major message basically to Europe and to the US, and US is more active and stronger here than the European Union, I believe. But then of course there is a message to Putin to let us go, because he's really he really has this idea that Ukrainians and Russians should be together and should constitute the same people, and that Russia without Ukraine will not be the Eurasian Empire which he wants it to be. But Sochi Olympics is not that present in the minds of the people with the, you know, it's difficult to think about athletes when you have real troubles, and when you have people dying,
right,
and when you have people missing and kidnapped and all that.
No,
therefore,
of course, that makes sense. One last question regarding the international angle. This is slightly old news, but in the last few weeks, I guess a number of American politicians, including most notably the former presidential candidate and Republican Senator John McCain, who is certainly one of the more prominent politicians in the United States, came to Kiev and stood in solidarity with the demonstrators. And some people in the U.S. criticized this. I'm curious whether you think that the direct participation of American politicians and American notable figures on the side of the protest is good or bad for the protest?
I think it is good for protests, and we have many other politicians, we have many EU politicians who come to Maidan and support it. I think it is good because it shows that it gives certain cards to people who are saying, well, this is kind of supported by Americans, etc. But it's not that important in my view. What is more important is that people see that there is support on the part of the international community, on the part of the US and Europe, and for this moment on, this support is only kind of words and declarations without very clear steps, at least on behalf of the European Union, because the US has been reported of imposing certain restrictions on some of the members of the parliament representing the Yanukovych party. But note that the attack, one of the police attack on Maidan on 11th of December was made when two politicians, top politicians from the US and EU were here. Victoria Nuland from the Department of State, I think she's Assistant Secretary of State, right? Was here, and then Catherine Ashton, the head of the EU diplomacy, was here. So it was kind of a very cynical on the part of the Yanukovych to attack people when two top officials from the US and the EU are in Kyiv physically.
What would you like to see President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry do regarding this situation? I mean, do you think they've been appropriate in their response to it so far, or would you like to see more?
I think they should understand that basically the only real language that Yanukovych understands is force, symbolic or real. But let's speak about symbolic force. Because, I mean, Yanukovych is a kind of a, and his allies, we have to understand their psychology. This is kind of a people born, raised, I would say, raised in the 90s in these street clashes where, you know, you had to be firm after the collapse of the Soviet Union to get up. You had to be firm, and you had to be the concessions or dialogue was a sign of a weakness. So they live according to a principle: the winner takes it all, the zero sum game. Either you win or you lose, and the only language they understand is language of force and not language of arguments. So they like the language of blackmailing. They always blackmailing others, and they always, you know, trying to play their little games, and they never hold the word. For example, they always break the agreements. It is difficult to trust them, you know, when they lie to somebody, when they don't act as they promise, they consider that as their victory, you know, not as their loss of image, but as their victory. Which means that finally they play a very clever game, you know. So the West should react in the same way, you know, saying, you know, guys, we impose these and these sanctions on you, we impose these and these restrictions, visa bans and everything on some, you know, not probably very important politicians, to say that others can be also subject to sanctions too. So this should be a game, playing the game, the model if then. So if you continue, then we'll enlarge the sanctions. If you continue, then we'll apply the Magnitsky law to you, for example.
Yeah, that, right? The Magnitsky law is a bill that the U.S. Congress signed last year, which imposes, I guess, visa restrictions or bans on various corrupt Russian politicians, and the Russians responded by banning adoptions to the United States. It was a major sign of escalating tensions between the United States and Russia.
Yeah, because we have to understand that Ukraine is not Russia. Ukrainians are not Russians. Mm-hmm. In Russia, there is kind of a, you know, many people consider themselves as a certain, being an opponent to the West. Or, you know, if somebody persecutes us, well, they consider us to be good and probably right. So this is kind of, they consider it to be probably very good on their part, right? But in Ukraine, many of these oligarchs and officials, they have their accounts in Europe and in the US, and they have their children educated in Europe and in the US, and they have Western ambitions. For example, Mr. Akhmetov has his football club Shakhtar Donetsk, and who is playing in the European Champions League, and he has many ambitions of, you know, progressing, advancing each year in the European Champions League.
This is the richest man in Ukraine, right?
And if you put the restrictions on him, on his assets, on his accounts, and on his image in Europe, he will suffer a lot. And the West should understand that he has something to lose on the West. Uh-huh. He has something to lose on the West, and therefore he will hear the West's more firm voice. And for now on, at least, if you talk about the European Union, the situation is sad, because basically there are only declarations, only communique, only press releases, and in these press releases, wording is sometimes very, very, very strange.
Well, we should probably wrap up. But Volodymyr, is there anything more you'd like to say about, in particular, when we spoke last time, I remember, I asked you at the end if you were optimistic, and you said you generally were. Are you feeling more optimistic, less optimistic?
Well, I still feel optimistic, and I would like to stress that, basically I was stressing last time that Ukrainian protests were peaceful, and I still stress it, although media transport basically violent pictures, but this violence is still very much located, localized. And basically, this violence is a kind of a violence of responsive violence. It's not attacking. The protesters are responding to the 2 months violence, very, and tyranny on the part of the regime. And basically, what we lack on the part of the protesters, if you look at the images in the video, how the police, for example, tortures the protesters, for example, there were widely circulated video when they undressed a protester, and imagine the undressed person on the snow during very, very difficult weather conditions under snow, naked, totally naked, and they were torturing him and humiliating him. Of course, you will not find these tortures on the part of the protesters, because if protesters capture some, you know, soldiers or some sporty people hired by the regime, they simply very carefully explain them something to them, and very carefully let them go. So I would like to stress this point, that this violence and this attack is not a violence which is programmed, which is rather a violence which is emotional violence in response to the tyranny.
I understand. So I hope you stay safe. I hope that there is not more violence, and that some kind of forward-looking accommodation can be reached. It's Ukraine has sort of been stuck in stasis since the end of the Soviet Union, and it would be a great thing to see a government that's genuinely responsive to the wishes of its people. So thank you so much, Volodymyr, for
thank you. Thank you too, David. Thank you.